Yeah, so I get to talk with you guys today. And when I was reading through, I'm going to talk through a lot of Romans chapter 3. But when I was reading that, I was realized I'm given the last section of the first part of Romans. And the first part of Romans is about the wrath of God. So it's not a very fun service today. I want you to leave like somewhat uncomfortable. But I want this to be kind of like a group practice of like exercise. Like we go to the gym to get stronger. It's not comfortable while we're there, but ultimately we know our muscles are going to get stronger and they're going to come back. Even though the next day we might be walking like a baby giraffe. Like it doesn't feel good. And I think that's the point of this. I think so often in the church and just in the United States, we want to feel good. We want to feel comfortable. We want to be assured. And Tim's going to talk about that next time. So this time, especially with Ash Wednesday coming up, which is this upcoming Wednesday, which is a time to just like sit in the brokenness that we are in and to acknowledge that even though we can be trying as hard as we want and really have all the intentions of doing good, in a broken world, there's broken things and we're part of that. So that's just kind of like a caveat. Bear with me. It's going to be uncomfortable. You might think, oh, there's a text message that I can answer. You might think, oh, there's some sports game. I don't watch sports ball. So there might be a sports game coming up. But just stick with me, please. And now I want all of you just to imagine you are the church in Rome. That you have been working, trying to figure out, do the Gentiles need to be Jewish in order to be part of our church? Do they need to be circumcised? Are they allowed to eat whatever they want to eat? How does this work? And you hear Paul, like the Billy Graham of the time, like the person that the resurrected Jesus came and talked to, wrote a letter to you. And you're like, man, he's going to say, like, I'm good. Like, we're doing good things. Like, he decided to write to us. We know he's been trying to come to us, and now he's written to us. Let's see what he has to say. So that's like what I want to read, chapters 1-3, because I can't talk about chapters 3 without the beginning part. So this is kind of a recap and getting into what I'm going through. So you can start in chapters 1 if you want, or you can be like the early Romans and just listen. But I'll try not to be boring. So Paul, a servant of Christ Jesus, called to be an apostle and set apart for the gospel of God, the gospel he promised through the prophets in the Holy Scriptures regarding his son, who, as to his earthly life, was a descendant of David, and who, through the Spirit of holiness, was appointed the Son of God in power by his resurrection from the dead, Christ Jesus our Lord. Through him we received grace and apostleship to call all the Gentiles to the obedience that comes from faith for his name's sake. And you are also among those Gentiles who are called to belong to Jesus Christ. So that's a good start. Mm-hmm. To all in Rome who are loved by God and called to be his holy people, grace and peace to you from God the Father and from the Lord Jesus Christ. Wow, we're called holy people. First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for all of you because your faith is being reported all over the world. Like, that's going to be a good message. This is going to be a good letter to us. I'm excited. God, whom I serve in my spirit in preaching the gospel of Son, is my witness how constantly I remember you in my prayers at all times. And I love that now, at last, by God's will, the way may be opened for me to come to you. I long to see you so that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to make you strong. That is, that you and I may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith. He says we have faith again. That's good. And I don't want you to be unaware, brothers and sisters, that I have planned many times to come to you, but have been prevented, in order that I might have a harvest among you, just as I have had among other Gentiles. I am obligated both to Greeks and non-Greeks, both to the wise and the foolish. That is why I am so eager to preach the gospel also to you who are in Rome. This is the key verse that we all like. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, of this triumphant news of Jesus, because it is the power of God that brings salvation to everyone who believes, first to the Jew, then to the Gentile. For in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, a righteousness that is by faith, from first to last, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. So it's a good start. Like, he's calling us faithful. Like, this is going to be a good time. And I think Paul's really going to like us. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all godlessness and wickedness of people who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known to them about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain for them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. Kind of those people, like, we're doing it right. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God or gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory for the immortal God of the immortal God for images made to look like a mortal human being and birds and animals and reptiles. So God gave them over to all of these things that are following. And starting in verse 29, they have become filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. They are filled with envy, murder, strife, and deceit, and malice. They are gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, and boastful. They invent ways of doing evil. They disobey their parents. They have no understanding, no fidelity, no love, no mercy. Although they know God's righteous decree that those who do such things deserve death, they not only continue to do those very things, but also approve of those who practice them. That's who they are. And like, I'm glad I'm not them. But verse 2, or chapter 2, you therefore have no excuse, you who pass judgment on someone else. For at whatever point you judge one another, you are condemning yourself, because you pass judgment and you do the same things. Now we know that those things, that God's judgment against those who do such things is based on truth. So when you, a mere human being, pass judgment on them and yet do the same things, do you think you will escape God's judgment? Jumping to verse 5. But because of your stubbornness and your unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath against yourself for the day of God's wrath, when his righteous judgment will be revealed. Now jumping down to verse 17, just to save time for us. We've read this all. Now you, so me, it's everyone. If you call yourself a Jew, if you rely on the law and boast in God, if you know his will and approve what is superior because you are instructed by the law, if you are convinced that you are a guide for the blind, a light for those who are in the dark, an instructor for the foolish, a teacher of little children, because you have the law and the embodiment of the knowledge and truth, you then who teach yourselves, who teach others, do you not teach yourselves? Jumping to verse 24. As it is written, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And that kind of feels pertinent. I've seen a lot of people say, oh, you're a Christian? Like, I've seen what Christians are doing. So continuing on, verse 25. Circumcision has value if you observe the law, but if you break the law, you have become as though you have not been circumcised. So then if those who are not circumcised keep the law's requirements, will they be regarded as though they are not circumcised? The one who is not circumcised physically and yet obeys the law will condemn you, who, even though you have the written code and circumcision, you are a lawbreaker. A person is not a Jew who is one only outwardly, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a person is a Jew who is one inward, and circumcision is circumcision of the heart by the Spirit, not written, not by written code. Such a person's praise is not from other people, but from God. So chapter 1, we talked about those people. Chapter 2, Paul connected those people to us and said, if you think those people are bad, just wait until you look in the mirror. Look, wait until you see yourself, because ultimately we're all people. And this is one of the key things that Paul is trying to get at in these first couple chapters, is connecting all people in unity, not as initially this chosen group for God, but as this group that God chose, and they've been acting unfaithful. We can see over and over in the Old Testament, God gives promises. God says, I am faithful to you. If you can be faithful to me, then this is going to work. You are going to be kings. You are going to be priests. You are going to bring the nations together in this glorious bride, essentially, of Jesus. So then we get to chapter 3. And chapter or verses 1 through 8, it's a bit of a back and forth, so I'm going to stand here for one side, here for the other. So what advantage then is there in being a Jew, or what value is there in the circumcision? But much in every way, because first of all, the Jews have been entrusted with the very words of God. But if some are unfaithful, doesn't that unfaithfulness make it seem like God is unfaithful? Does it nullify God's faithfulness? No, by no means, as Mark sometimes says, really, guys? Like, that's kind of his way of saying it. It's absolutely not. Let God be true, and let every human being be a liar. As it is written, this is when David was writing about Bathsheba, or writing the psalm after Bathsheba, so that God may be proven right when he speaks and prevail when he judge. But if our unrighteousness brings about God's righteousness more clearly, then maybe we should be as bad as we can be, so that way God can save us from more. It's like those testimonies we hear of, like, this person who comes up all tattooed and it's like totally just like what we perceive as a broken human being. It says, I was doing all these wrong things, but look how God has saved me and made me so good. And we like those stories because it sees how much God can save even the baddest person. I've been reading through the kids' storybook Bible with my kids, and James has been, my five-year-old, has been trying to, like, figure out how God can save people. And I've been trying to tell him, like, he wants even the bad people to come to know him. And one time he's like, God wants even, like, the baddest man who's always in jail to come to him. I was like, yes, like, that's right. Like, he wants all people to come to him. And that baddest man is not that different from us. Like, he's still a person. So then, starting in verse 5, but if our unrighteousness brings about God's righteousness more clearly, what shall we say? That God is unjust in bringing his wrath on us? But certainly not. If that were so, how could God judge the world? How could God have integrity and character and keep his promises if he just lets things slide? Someone might argue then, if my falsehood enhances God's truthfulness and so increases his glory, why am I still condemned as a sinner? Why not say, as some slanderously say, that we say, let us do good that may evil may result. Their condemnation is just. I'm going to start with those as a big intro. I'm going to start with those first 8 verses, though. And starting in verses 1 and 2, that first question, is there any advantage in being a Jew? So at the end of chapter 2, it said circumcision is not important. The Jewish practices aren't effective in the saving act that we thought they were as Jews. So Paul says they have the words and the promises of God. And now I want to turn it over to you and ask you, what else do you think the Jews, what's the advantage of being a Jew for them at that time? They had the words and the promises of God. Do you think there's any other advantages?
You know what's expected to become part of the covenant family.
Yeah, you know what's expected.
You've had, like, this long history to, like, look back on.
Yeah.
Where, like, the Gentiles aren't going to have much. I mean, they just recently
became
the Gentile nation, so you don't have this long tradition. Culture.
Yeah. You have, like, this huge backing of, like, when you ask questions, you're like, well, let's look at what thousands of years of people have said.
To that point, too, maybe you've heard, maybe your parents, like, have told you about being a Jew, about this faithful God. So you have already have the knowledge of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had the temple to worship in. They had their sacrificial system, which provided a covering for their sins.
Yeah.
But others did not.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting when I think about that. It's like, it's a benefit, and yet also Paul kind of sees it as a stumbling block at the same time. It's like, yeah. And one of the other things I was thinking of, too, was they've seen the faithfulness of God. They have all these stories of people, like, when talking about David and Bathsheba, it's like, this was God's chosen person, and they really messed up. God gave them a promise, and he could have left at that point, but he said, no, I'm going to work on it. I'm going to redeem it. I'm going to restore it. And that is huge, like the history, the relationship aspect of it. And in the practices of it, like that's how you get to know people, is by doing things with them. I agree with all of that. And then going on to verses 3 and 4 of the faithfulness of God for the unfaithful. So it says, if I'm unfaithful, God made these promises. And if I'm unfaithful and I don't hold up to that promise, then isn't it God's fault that he told me to do those things because it didn't work? Like, isn't God ultimately in the wrong? It's like the classic Garden of Eden story. It's like, well, I ate it because this person said so. Well, that's because the snake told me. Well, God, why did you even put it in the garden? Couldn't there be a better way? Ultimately, it's like, it's easy to work our way to it's God's fault instead of saying, no, it's my fault. Because God is continuously faithful. There's a verse in 2 Timothy 2 that says, if we deny ourselves, God will also, or if we deny God, God will also deny us. But if we are faithless, God will remain faithful, because God cannot deny himself. And so I think that talks about how the hardness of God's heart, the anger of God, is temporary, but ultimately he's faithful. Because if he was unfaithful to us, then he is denying himself. That's where he is going against the promises that he has made to the Jewish people and ultimately to us. Going on to verses 5 and 6. So this is, again, the section where if God's light is seen as brighter, if it's darker, it's kind of like looking at the moon at nighttime versus looking at it when the sun's coming up. It's like, why not let us be as bad as we can? Or why not let our badness show so that way God's grace can be seen? And this goes even more into verses 7 and 8. Like, so let's see how far God's glory can go. And I ultimately think of teenagers in this point. It's like, how close to the edge can I get to do something before something happens? So in the church, it was like, oh, I have this high school girlfriend. How far can I go with them? Or if I go to a party, I'm like, or how many drinks can I have before I can't drive home or before it's going to cause me to be hungover? How late can I stay up? How close to the edge of whatever can I get? And I really think that's the wrong question that we're asking. It's not how far can we go before God can save us. It's what are we following? What direction are we facing? So like, say God's over here, and this is some boundary barrier line between someone who's living, quote unquote, in the Jewish way, in the law. Today's time, they would look like a good Christian. And then over there is all the other people. It's not about where I'm physically standing. It's about, am I looking at God or am I not looking at God? It's not about where you've been or what you've done, because right here Paul is saying it doesn't matter where you're standing. You could be standing over at the mountains. You've just been living a life for yourself against other people. Even non-Christians would say, why would that person be doing that? And if they choose to turn from their ways and look towards God, yeah, they still have all those consequences, but they're looking at God and they're walking in that direction. So love for God is not about the destination or where you are. It's about the direction you're going in. And kind of to the point you all have been saying, the relationship that the Jewish people had had with God, it's not just about getting to heaven. It's not about what happens when you die. It's about living life right now because God made us to live the best way with him. And so it doesn't matter, like I said, if you're far off or if you're close, but if you can turn to him and follow him, then that is going to be the best way to live in this human life. And so why would we wait? Why would we wait until another time to do it? Why would we say, well, there's the edge, let's see how close we can get? Because we all hear stories, we live in Colorado, of people getting too close to edges, thinking that they're safe, and then they fall and something terrible happens. And that really could happen to a lot of us. Kind of going off script, but Kelsey and I saw, we were at Costco the other day and saw a guy get hit by a car. And he really hurt his leg, like an ambulance came and took him away. But it's like, he was doing his normal thing, walking across the street, and somebody smacked into him. And it wasn't, I didn't see it happen, but it's like, those things happen. As a chaplain in the hospital, I see lots of accidents where somebody else was at fault, but we get the consequences, because I think this is just a broken world, and that's what happens in the communities that we're in, is brokenness happens. There's not really a whole lot of assurance. I do want to do a bit of a thought process now, a bit of an exercise. It might be a little uncomfortable again. That's the answer for today. I have on my fridge a feelings chart to help my kids understand feelings. You start in the middle and you pick one, and then like it nuances it as it goes out. And the first thing that we pick, is it a comfortable feeling or an uncomfortable feeling? And today is just a lot of uncomfortable feelings. It's not bad feelings, they're just uncomfortable. So bear with me, because you might be thinking, I'm faithful. I've been living this life. I've been pursuing God. I've been facing Him. And I think a lot of us here are really trying to follow God as best we know how. Mark talks a lot about how we are following God as best we know how in this time, just as the people in the Bible were following God as best they knew how at that time. It's not how we're supposed to mirror them exactly, but how do we choose this relationship and choose to follow God? And somebody asked me a long time ago now, when you have an uncomfortable emotion or something feels out of control, where do you turn to first? What's that gut instinct of where you want to turn? Because they said anything that isn't turning directly to God is potentially an idol in your life. So if when that guy first got hit, my first thought was, I'm going to run over and help them. It wasn't, oh God, please help this person. And I think it's not saying like, I can't think these things. I want to nuance it. But I do want to think we need to have God as part of our thought processes, of God being ultimately in control. And it's easy to do that in big things that we can't control. If there's a natural disaster that happens, it's easy to say, God, please help us. We need this. If there's a national catastrophe, it's easy to think, God, we need you to help in this. And we see this in our own brokenness or in our own smaller community. If we see how much hurt a little girl can have in her life and we feel out of control and she's not able to stay with us. If we hear these stories of people in our community that are losing life-saving insurance or health, if money is being taken away from services that are being used to help somebody, and we are able to see the direct consequences of it, then it's easy to say, God, we need you. We can't do this without you. I think it's harder, at least for me, in the smaller things, the things I can control, where I can fix it by watching TV, or I can distract myself by looking at my phone, or I can go exercise so I'm too tired to even think about anything. And so I don't want you to answer necessarily, but I do want you to think, like, what things am I doing that are stopping me from turning fully to God? When I'm tired, do I sit and say, God, I'm tired, I need you? Or do I turn on the TV and look at my phone while the TV's on, so hopefully the noise and the flashing lights distracts me from my tiredness? And I'm, again, it's kind of like how Paul is doing. He starts saying, like, you. In this section, he's saying we. I'm not pointing at you as much as I'm pointing at myself. I'll honestly be glad when we're on to the next section, because this is uncomfortable, and I don't like this section in my body. Like, I don't like feeling these things and feeling how much I need God and how much I can't do these things. I can't follow God fully and do it well without him. I do want to jump then to verses 9 through 20. So then, after we've gone through this back and forth with these questions, what shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage as Jewish people? Not at all. For we have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin. So there is the advantage, like the relational advantage of all the things that we talked about, of having the history of those things. But ultimately, it's not an advantage because we are all under the power of sin. And sin is a really obscure word. It's kind of hard for people to pin down and say, like, what is sin? In this context, I want to label it two ways. One, I want to label it as unfaithfulness. It's for in the relationship with God, God has said, I will be faithful to you, and I want you to be faithful to me. In Deuteronomy, he gave this long list of commands. And the very first one is, love God, love me, I will be with you, you will be my people, and I want you to be circumcised in the circumcision of the heart because I want you to be transformed and changed so we can have this great relationship. And so sin is anything that causes us to be unfaithful. And then in the broader context of within this church, within the larger Christian context and the world, I want to label it as evil. Things that are evil. We see it in movies, we see it in shows, where there's just so much evil in something, and it doesn't sit with us. We say, that can't happen. Like, it's not like we see on signs out here of things that are like promiscuous, where it's like, ooh, sin, oh, this like worldliness. It's really evil. And ultimately, what Paul is saying is we, to some extent, are part of a world that is ruled, that is under the power of this evilness. And as living in this world, there is evil that permeates us. I was reading a quote and it says, how hard it is to come to the conclusion of that, because to get rid of all evil, we have to get rid of some of ourselves. And how hard it is to get rid of parts of ourselves, to lose parts of our heart, things that we identify with and like our core to our being. But God's saying, we want to renew that. We want to restore that. We want to take that hardness and make it soft, even though making it soft is going to make it vulnerable, is going to make it potentially get injured. If it was a rock, it'd be easy. You can care for a rock. That's why we used to have pet rocks. But it's harder to care for a plant. And so that's how I want to define it. Unfaithfulness and evil. My page keeps flipping. And then Paul goes into this long list of sections from Psalm, sections from Isaiah, Ecclesiastes. And a lot of these were initially towards Gentile people, the people that we saw in chapter 2 of they do this, they do that. But then Paul connected it to you do this, you do this. And now he's like, we do this as a people. And he says, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. Their throats are open graves. Their tongues practice deceit. The poison of vipers is on their lips. The mouths are full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Ruin and misery mark their ways. In the way of peace they do not know. There is no fear of God before their eyes. When I first read through that, I read through it really quickly. I was like, okay, yeah, we're to some verses, and I'll jump to like, what does Paul mean by this? But the more I read through this, the more I've been able to pinpoint parts of my life that I don't have any fear of God. There's parts of my life that I feel are just so secure, that I am so in control, that I think God's not really gonna change them. And I think even if he tried, like, I could stop him. And I know that's silly saying it out loud. But like, I think if God said, maybe there's these people that you know that are really struggling financially, and God brought it upon me to take some of my 401k to help them, some of my retirement for 40 years from now so I can be the responsible person, I don't think I would be able to do that. And that's a spot that's like the fear of God and trust in God. It goes hand in hand, because to have the fear that, like the righteous fear that God is going to bring about community restoration, which means I might have to sacrifice something, is hard to accept when I could just stay in my safe bubble and do the things that I want to do instead of trust God and make sacrifices for myself. That's one example. There's a couple others that I'm like, I don't really have God fully invested and integrated into these parts of my life. And I think that's kind of what Paul is saying here. So we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, so that every mouth may be silenced and the whole world held accountable to God. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by the works of the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of our sin. It's hard to look at the law because the law shows us the issues that we have, the brokenness that we have. The times we are in a broken world and brokenness happens and we see people get hurt or things that are really just not just, where we see corrupt systems taking control of vulnerable people, where we see people in power call other people less than human. And that, it's easy to say, those are big wrongs. It's a lot harder to say, I don't fear God in these things. I'm choosing to whatever. I'm choosing to take control of whatever situation because I think I can be in control better than the slow, steady work of God. And I think knowing about Paul's history of being a Jew, the Jew among Jews, like the best. He was born into it, he knew everything, he was on the right path. And Jesus came and said, no, you're doing it wrong. He had a new way to look at the law and see how the law was intended to be this thing that brought everyone together. And yet it ended up being this thing that divided, that created stumbling blocks and barriers. And you had to do all these things in order to follow God. And instead of just turning and looking at him, you had to get yourself from over there to right here so that way God could accept you. And so the more Paul looked at the law, the more he saw how the law really didn't point out the greatness of Israel. It really pointed out the flaws of Israel. But regardless of whether the law was there or not, doesn't mean it was being broken or not. Like, you could get pulled over speeding, and the cop says, how fast were you, or do you know what the speed limit is? And if you don't, you say, I don't know. And he says, you are going 15 over, here's your ticket. And he's justified in doing that. And in the same way, these first three chapters show that God would be fully justified in saying, I wanted you to be my wife. I wanted you to be the bride. I was faithful to you. you were unfaithful. I'm going to divorce you. God would be fully just in saying that. And we see that in the first 8 verses, the back and forth questions of saying, like, well, God could still just save us even though we're unfaithful. And Paul saying, but God wouldn't be just if he did that. By the end of verse 20, it really feels like there's no way out. It really feels like we've dug our own grave. God's saying there and saying, I'm justified, sorry. Like, we tried, it was a good run. Like, maybe I'll choose someone else next time. And I really wish that I was given more of chapter 3, because this is the turning point. It happens. Yeah, it's good, though, because these uncomfortable emotions are where we grow. This is the exercise that I'm talking about. It's not meant for us to stay in this spot. And as soon as we get to the second half of chapter 3, that's where we can turn. And I'm really tempted to bring us there and bring us out of this. But I do want us to sit in it, because I've heard so many times that you can't just preach Jesus to somebody. You have to show them that there's a problem that needs to be solved. If there's no problem, then why would anybody need a solution? If there's no issue, if I think I'm perfect, then why would I need anything else? It's like how when Paul was Saul, he says, I'm doing all the right things. Why do I need anyone else? But as we read more and more of Paul, he calls himself, from being the Jew among Jews, he says, I'm the chief of sinners. And I found that as I read more of the Bible, I think, man, like, I thought I was good. I thought I was doing things right. But I read things like this, and I think of them, and I take them to God and say, God, like, what caused you to choose me still? And I want us to sit in that discomfort a little bit. I don't want it to turn to despair. I want us to remember that after our workout, we get to leave the gym and go into the warm spring sunlight. But for right now, just sit into that discomfort. That's what I have to bring for you all. I do want to hear some of your thoughts, though, on the ton of words I've said.
I think the end of verse 11 is interesting. None is righteous, no, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. And I found that interesting. If we come to him, he comes to us first. He calls us. Mm-hmm. And it's just our responsibility to reply correctly.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the story of the prodigal son. It's like the Jews,
yes,
feel like they're the son that was the good son, the obedient son.
Mm.
And the Gentiles are like the prodigal son. And the Jews are like, no, we've been good. We've been doing all the things you've asked us to do. And God's like, no, we're reaching out to the prodigal side. We're reaching out to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I've always had you here. Like, we've been celebrating every day with you here. And now we have more people. You have the other son to come back to.
Just as you listen to all this, it makes you painfully aware of what we've been talking about in the earlier weeks of Romans, about this gargantuan job that Paul has, convincing the Jews that there's nothing wrong with bringing the Gentiles in. And in fact, all of this stuff that you've been doing for thousands of years has now panned out to make you stand up above them and be able to look down on them, but you're on the same playing field. And then we question thousands of years later, how come the Jews still don't get that Jesus did the job?
Mm.
No wonder they're trying. He's trying to undo thousands and thousands of years of, you know, everything we were talking earlier about. We have this great relationship and all this history of how he's redeemed our problems. So it feels like we're on the right path, but now you're telling us we're not.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Yeah. Or like, this is the way to God. This is the way to have a relationship, by being Jewish. And now they're saying, well, there's also another way. And like, that sounds really Gnostic to me. Like, there's many, many paths up to the same top of the hill. It's like, it's really, yeah, it'd be really tough to continually be fighting to keep what you see as like the purity of your culture and your faith. And then they're like, oh yeah, and let's just bring some more people in. It'd be really tough. Yeah.
I think our understanding of sin really affects our understanding of this. There's no non-righteous, there's no one. Like, I don't know for sure if this is what Paul's saying, but it's kind of like, if you have these advantages of being Jewish, I kind of think of it as like having advantages in our day and age of like maybe growing up in a Christian home, a Christian community, and stuff. And like, I think a lot about like, I grew up that way, right? But somehow, like through all these different ways, God showed me, like to really internalize that. I don't know who to credit with this phrase of like, our sin is so much deeper than we think it is, but God's grace is so much more than we think it is. You know, and
yeah.
I think like to be Jewish in that time, maybe you could be tempted to think, you know, we're here. And as long as we don't sin, meaning break the law, then we're okay, and then we can do these things to like restore ourselves back to here, right?
Yeah.
Sin restores and restores.
Uh-huh.
But I think like what Paul's saying is like sin is also just our natural man reactions to the sin that has been done to us.
Mm-hmm.
And having kids with trauma or having kids with neurodiversity, like we really learn that, right? Because like. I do what I don't want to do. You know what I
mean?
Like,
yeah.
We learn that through our own lives, but also like through the kids that like do what they know is wrong, and like, but they're doing it out of a reaction that they develop to protect themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we all do that. That's just human nature. Like it's in nature.
Yeah.
You know, and so like. That puts us all on that equal footing, like, and I don't know, it's I think today still, like, people don't see that, like, and I don't know how I got to a place, how I got, like, lucky enough that God showed me that over and over again in different ways, and, like, no, sin's a lot deeper than you think, and it's not just doing bad things, it's you're born into it and you react, your physical body reactions like led you to this place, and so your need for Jesus is so much different than anything. And so like that uncomfortable, I feel like I've been living in that for quite a few years, but it makes that's like Jesus, what Jesus did, like so much more meaningful.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not just to like make up for the mean thing I said to somebody. It's like to really pull me out of this deep darkness. Sorry, I'm talking
no.
so
No, you're great, yeah.
Yeah.
We should switch spots next time.
No,
that's great. It's so much a part of like who I am. Where it's so reactionary and who like it's so much deeper, and I think I don't know where it, remember where it says this, but it's where sin abounds, grace abounds more. Where it's not about doing bad things so God can save us more. It's about realizing how helpless I am of saving myself and how much I actually need God to be there. It's not just that I want him or that I like him sometimes. It's that I deeply, innately, I need him. I can't do it without him. I can't change without him. There's just no growth without him. And it says, apart there's no one who does good, not even one. Like, apart from me, you can do nothing. And that's hard for me to grasp. It's easy for me to say, hard for me to grasp. Yeah?
I mean, aren't we all Gentiles? Like, we weren't born into Jewish families. So, like, if the Jews didn't accept Gentiles at one point, like, none of us would know about God. None of us would feel like we could follow.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, that feels hopeful to me in this. And, like, looking at other people that, I don't know,
definitely a lot of hope based on the context that we know of what's coming and just reading through some of the Gospels the last year or so. I do want to end it with a section of Hosea. My Bible, it's page 904. Hosea is a really weird book, I think. And at the end, he talks about a lot of poetry. And it talks, the whole book is about God's faithfulness to an unfaithful people. If you don't want to read it, you can look at the Bible Project. It's great. I love it. Has little animations, always good. But this is what God says about Israel at that time. And we are now part of Israel through the work of Jesus. He says, I will heal, and I'm going to caveat, I'm going to make it a little more modern, so if you're following along, I might not say the cedars of Lebanon. That doesn't mean anything to me. I will heal their waywardness and love them freely, for my anger has turned away from them. I will be like a dew to Israel. He will blossom like a lily, like the great cedars. He will send down his roots. His young shoots will grow. Israel's splendor will be like an olive tree. His fragrance will be like those great cedars. People will dwell again in his shade, and they will flourish like the grain. They will blossom like the vine. Israel's fame will be like the wine from Italy. Ephraim, what more have I to do with idols? I will answer him and care for him. I, God, am like a flourishing juniper, and your fruitfulness comes from me.